The court will proceed to the fourth case of the day, the United States versus Montgomery. Mr. Cook.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Dan Cook. I'm an attorney with the Federal Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois. I represent the appellant, Calvin Montgomery, in this appeal. There's one issue in this appeal, whether the district court erred when it denied Mr. Montgomery's motion to suppress his statements. We've submitted three reasons why this was error. First is that Mr. Montgomery's statements were induced by a false promise of lenience, the violation of the Fifth Amendment self-incrimination clause. Second is that the statements were involuntary in their totality of the circumstances. It's more of a due process-oriented argument. The third is a Michigan v. Mosley issue, whether the officer scrupulously honored Mr. Montgomery's invocation of his right to remain silent. I'm probably going to focus mainly just on the first issue, but I can answer questions if this court has any on the second and third, but I probably won't get to them. With respect to the first issue, the argument is fairly simple. Agent Heiser told Mr. Montgomery, you're not going to get 10 years, Calvin. Mr. Montgomery got 15, 15 and a half, actually.
So but was the agent's statement a promise, or was it what reason is there to think this was some promise of lenience as opposed to just the agent's own random prediction?
Well, I think that's the government's position, that there is no promise. But, you know, I think the focus would be on the agent's intent. You know, did the agent intend for this to be a promise? And our position is that's not the law. And the government provides no case law that says that's what we look at. We just don't. The answer isn't what he intended. The case law says we look at the effect on the defendant. We can do that in this case. He was told he wasn't going to get 10 years. Then he made incriminating statements.
Do you think, are you interpreting the case law to require us to look at the subjective intent of that defendant, or is it more that we should just look at the words spoken by the agent and decide as an objective matter whether a reasonable person could understand this as a promise of leniency?
I think it's probably more the latter. I think there's case law is really, I wouldn't say very specific on this issue. A lot of it ends prematurely. I mean, I don't know that there's any case that gets into intent. I certainly didn't find one.
I mean, the problem for you, it was a very interesting brief to read, I have to say, but the problem is that there's a lot of water under the bridge with respect to the rule announced in Bram, and most of it is all in the direction of totality of the circumstances analysis, and on the totality of these circumstances, there are rather lengthy periods of time between these things. There are a couple of rounds, maybe not as many rounds as you think there should have been, but a couple of rounds of Miranda warnings, and so we would have to find under the totality of the circumstances that there was pressure, inappropriate pressure on Mr. Montgomery.
Right. Well, our first point is that at some point, Bram became disfavored, apparently in the mid-80s.
Well, and maybe another way of putting it is at some point the Supreme Court itself starts interpreting Bram in a narrower way rather than a broader way. The court frequently does that with its prior cases. It will say, well, this circumstance was important or that circumstance was important.
Right. Well, I don't know that there's a case, there's Fulminante, where the court says this is no longer the standard for voluntariness. That case was a due process clause case. It's a habeas case. You know, Bram interprets self-incrimination clause. It's a federal defendant. So there's that difference. And there's the fact that it was dicta. And then you have the fact that in 2000 in Dickerson, the court cites Bram. No indication that it's been overruled. 2 years after Fulminante, the court talks about Bram and Withrow v. Williams.
Well, so, and insofar as if you were to ask somebody the question, is there still a rule that requires suppression of confessions that are induced through unduly coercive tactics or something like that, you would say, yes, there is still such a rule. But how far you go in the direction of anything that can tip the balance has changed. And so, for example, truthful statements are considered fair game. You know, that's something that someone rationally might take into account.
Right. And I think even in this court's precedent, when it talks about Brand as being no longer good law, for instance, Baldwin, 1995, the court still says, quote, false promise of lenience would be an example of forbidden tactics, for it would impede the suspect in making an informal choice as to whether he was better off confessing or climbing up. So I think there still is a recognition by this court that a false promise of lenience is enough to induce a confession. And that seems very clear to me that an officer simply can't tell somebody he's going to receive a benefit, like a certain amount of time in jail, and then not come through on it. That seems very much an inducement, very much coercive.
And do you think every statement that the officer makes is automatically a promise?
I think if it induces a confession, it has to be.
What if the agent says, you're likely to appear before a judge who tends to be a lenient judge? Is that coercive?
No. No. I think there's a line. You know, the government cites the Stewart case, where in about three sentences, this court says an argument on a false promise of lenience is frivolous. Well, it was. I mean, in that case, the guy argued that, you know, a statement that you'll be all right if you had no direct involvement in this case somehow induced him. The problem with that is, one, he had direct involvement. He admitted that he committed a robbery by himself. So there is no promise to keep an uphold there. And two, this isn't a case where Agent Heiser says, Calvin, tell us what happened, you'll be all right. I mean, clearly that's not what happened. Our position is that under Bram, under a modified Bram's rule, even under the totality of circumstances, confession was coerced. See that I'm in rebuttal? Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Ms. Scott.
Your Honors, first I will address, the pleases of the court, co-counsel. First I'll address the defense argument that there was a false promise of lenience. If you look at the words that Agent Heiser used, what he said was, the state could be worse. If you're going to get time, let me cite exactly to it. Well, if you get time, you're not going to get 10 years. Agent Heiser never said, look, Calvin, if you talk to us, you're not going to get 10 years. If you agree to give us a statement, I'll make sure you don't get 10 years. There was absolutely no promise here. As Agent Heiser testified, that statement was based on his experience with felon in possession cases in both the state and federal system, that there was a potential for someone with the defendant's criminal history to get a potentially longer sentence in the state system. And also, as he testified, the typical felon in possession case is not going to get give the defendant a sentence of the 10-year statutory maximum. The only time that happens is if someone has a criminal history that jumps up the base offense level, or if they're an ACC, which it turned out that Mr. Montgomery was. He turned out to be an armed career criminal.
But Agent Heiser had looked at the police report on Mr. Montgomery.
Right,
he had priors.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why would he keep saying this comment about the 10 years, and what keeps striking me as rather odd, that he might be worse off in the state system? That's not usually the case, but whatever. But why does he keep mentioning this 10-year number when he sees that Mr. Montgomery is not a newcomer to the law?
Right. You know, and Your Honor, like I said, he testified that the reason he did that was, and I can only speculate as to, I mean, I can only tell you what he testified to, because, of course, I can't, you know, speculate as to what he meant, but or why he did it. But he said that he did it because, in his experience, not many federal prisoners get the 10-year statutory maximum. And that's what he was trying to explain to Mr. Montgomery. Now, there was a lot of testimony at the suppression hearing about what exactly showed up on the NCIC and if you could read the NCIC to indicate whether or not he was an armed career criminal. And although there was a res burg, and I believe there was a regular burglary, it didn't appear from reading the NCIC I believe the evidence showed that he could not tell just from reading that NCIC when he first interviewed the defendant that there was a possibility that he was an armed career criminal. And also based on the conversations he's had with the defendant. So I believe that what he said, he didn't say it with the hope of trying to coerce the defendant into talking.
Well, that's the agent's motivation. Whatever's going on here, whether it's the subjective understanding of the defendant or whether it's how a reasonable person would understand the words that came out of the agent's mouth, the standard is not what the agent secretly in his heart of hearts meant to convey.
Correct, Your Honor.
So we need to look, what's actually said as far as we're able to reconstruct that.
Right. And again, Your Honor, as I said in my brief, I believe that if you look at the statement that Agent Heiser gave, if you look at the way he gave it on the videotape statement, it's clear it was not some type of promise, whether explicit or implicit. It was not, Calvin, talk to us and you won't get 10 years.
Suppose we thought it wasn't a promise, but instead it was a prediction. In my experience, you're likely to get less than 10 years. He's not promising anything, but under the totality of the circumstances and the rules that we have that are designed to protect the defendant's Fifth Amendment privilege, would that be something that we should be concerned about?
No, Your Honor. Actually, I believe that that would even be less of a promise than what he actually said, because here he's saying my prediction. He's saying, is that you wouldn't get 10 years. I mean, no reasonable person could believe, I would think, that if someone said, I predict you're not going to get 10 years, that means I'm not going to get 10 years, because it's clear that's what he's just saying.
Even though Mr. Montgomery is a person of limited intellectual abilities and might attach great weight to what somebody in a position of authority like Agent Heiser says?
Well, Mr. Montgomery, that was one of his main arguments, was that he was of limited intelligence. But if you look at the fact that when he spoke with Detective Riddle that morning, he went through the Miranda rights form, initialed, signed it, and then refused to give a statement. And he said, I refused to give a statement to Detective Riddle because I didn't know if he was trying to trick me or not. Mr. Montgomery was smart enough to notice right away when they put that form on that table in front of him, hey, this is not the same form I filled out this morning. He was also smart enough to try to explain why his prints would be on that gun and to try to minimize his conduct by saying, oh, I only got the gun right before I threw it out the window. And he also was smart enough to try to demonstrate to the officers, look, the officer couldn't have seen me drop the gun because he was standing here and I was standing here. And so it wasn't like he was sitting there not trying to explain himself, not trying to offer explanations for what he did, trying to mitigate what he did. I mean, he was smart enough to know, look, I don't want to just say, hey, I had this gun in my pocket and I got out and kicked it under the car. Also, as the judge pointed out, the officers did nothing to coerce him when he was confused, and he was obviously confused about some of the Miranda rights. What the judge noted was, look, the agent smartly pulled this form back out and said, look, yeah, you're asking me if I say something, is that going to incriminate me? Look at what you just signed. It says, if you say something, it can be used against you. When he asked about the lawyer, it said, look, it says here, if you want to get a lawyer,
you can get a lawyer. He didn't get a warning before his interim statement, though, did he?
But, Your Honor,
allegedly they didn't give him any because they weren't going to talk about the case, I suppose, but he made an incriminating statement in the course of the
Well, no, actually, in the roll call room, the only statement he made was, I didn't, it's not my gun. And the agent said, well, if it's not your gun, then why don't you go upstairs and give a videotaped interview? And as both agents testified, the reason they pulled him in that roll call room was because two of the passengers were in the jail cell with Mr. Montgomery, and they didn't want to talk about the case with him while those two people were present. And in this roll call room, the discussion was mainly, look, this is why I'm here, or this is why Agent Heiser is saying, this is why I'm here, this is could potentially be a federal case, blah, blah, blah. And then they had discussion about why would it go federal rather than state, and Mr. Montgomery's apparently marital and drinking problems. But never, never, both officers testified, they never asked him about the facts of the case, and that was why they did not feel that they needed to read him his Miranda rights. There was no interrogation at that time. And if you look at the videotape statement, they did not start going into the facts of the case until after they had answered each and every one of Mr. Montgomery's questions about that Miranda rights form and said, you know, Calvin, do you understand? You know, do you, or when he asked about the lawyer, they tried to explain to him, well, look, you know, I don't know what if it's a benefit or not for you to get a lawyer, but you have the right to get a lawyer. I mean, they never said, look, you are going to talk to us. You have to talk to us. Never. There was no coercion. The district court acknowledged that the officers left the decision as to whether or not to talk up to the defendant, and the defendant himself was the one that made that decision.
Well, this 10-year statement is in the context of his concern about federal versus state. As I interpret the 10-year statement, it's a statement that, well, that you're not likely to get 10 years in the federal prosecution.
Right, but again, Your Honor, I mean, I don't see how a reasonable person would assume that by an officer saying, well, you're not likely to get 10 years in the federal system interpreting that to mean, gee, if I sit here and talk to these officers right now, I'm not going to get 10 years. I mean, there's absolutely nothing in that statement that implies that if he talks, he's not going to get 10 years. It's just the officer saying, look, you're probably not going to get 10 years, which he probably wouldn't have if he hadn't been an armed career criminal. And at the time, the officer did not know that he was an armed criminal. In fact, at the time he interviewed him, he didn't even know if the case was going to go federal. I'm out of time if you don't have any further questions. Thank you.
Mr. Cook.
First of all, Agent Heiser never said it. You're probably going to get 10 years. He never said you're not likely to get 10 years. He said you're not going to get 10 years. That's what he said. It's a completely different case if he says something else. Second, the only reason they were having the conversation was because Agent Heiser wanted him to give statements. So the government's position that this was somehow not related to giving a statement, that he just said it just to say it, can't be true. I mean, he said it because he wanted Calvin to give a statement. Now, 2008, the United States Supreme Court, United States v. Rodriguez, if the judge told the defendant that the maximum possible sentence was 10 years and then imposed a sentence of 15 years based on the ACCA, the defendant would have been sorely misled and would have a ground for moving to withdraw the plea. Now, that in that context, it's an issue of voluntariness. The Supreme Court can say that is involuntary. I mean, that's this case. That is this case. The exact same thing. We're in the context of voluntariness, and it's as plain as day to us. And I'll also note, with respect to Bram, another recent case, Heller. If you look at the analysis in Heller, what Justice Scalia did in Heller, and compare that to what the court did in Bram, I mean, it's identical. To say that Bram is no longer good law, it doesn't make sense. I mean, the Supreme Court to this day is still doing this originalist intent interpretation of these clauses. It's exactly what Bram did. And Bram concluded that confessions extracted by promises are inadmissible. And I'll also note... this doctrinal difference between the totality of the circumstances and Bram. It's not one or the other. There seems to be this feeling that it's either the totality or it's either Bram. But the problem is when the court incorporates an amendment, you don't lose your rights. And that's essentially what it appears has happened. When the court incorporated the Fifth Amendment in Malloy, we somehow lose Bram. Well, that can't be true. It just means that Bram applies to the states. It doesn't mean that the analysis shifts away from Bram. I mean, Bram can still be good law in light of the totality analysis. We just ask that this court suppress the statements. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cook. Thank you, Ms. Scott. The case is taken under advisement.